today on Doomed! Havana Syndrome. On this episode of Doomed with Matt Binder, we'll be talking about this mysterious whatever it is that apparently is affecting United States officials overseas. We'll break down exactly what's going on here, or what we think, or they think, is going on here. And maybe by the end of this show, I will have infected you all with Havana Syndrome, depending on what it is, whatever it may be. Who knows? And without any further ado, let me introduce to you my guest for this episode. First of all, let me bring her up on the screen here. There we are. Natalie Shore, a columnist for The New Republic. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you have a piece out in The New Republic, came out a couple of weeks ago, actually last month, with Havana Syndrome, Washington is repeating Colin Powell's worst mistake. And you also have a piece coming out, I believe, this weekend?
It should come out Saturday.
On Havana Syndrome. And you really are, in my opinion, the official Havana Syndrome person. You are the expert on this, at least in terms of people looking at it and not just taking it for what, U.S. officials are claiming it is without any real definitive proof.
Well, thanks. I can't take total credit. A lot of people have done a ton of skeptical reporting before me. I think that, I've done a lot of research and synthesis, and I think I'm angrier and more exasperated than a lot of the people who have done this reporting before me, but I don't want to take credit for it. People like Jack Hitt, Dan Hurley have done some really great reporting, and, without some of the things that they've brought to light, I think that this story would be a little murkier.
Perfect. And, you being the most angry about it is exactly why you're perfect for the show.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, people are probably listening and wondering, let's take it from here. Let's say you know nothing about Havana Syndrome. You haven't heard about it at all in the news. What is Havana Syndrome?
So this story is several years in the making. It came to light publicly in early to mid 2017, but it started a bit before that. At the very, very end of 2016 in Cuba, someone that we now know was a CIA operative under diplomatic cover felt really sick all of a sudden. Some odd symptoms, some dizziness, some hearing loss, some ringing in his ears, some headaches, things like that. Shows up at the embassy medical center. They don't really know what to make of it. He experiences similar symptoms a few weeks later. At some point, either he floats the idea or someone else, they kind of start to wonder, hey, is this related to this really odd ringing sound I've been hearing a lot lately at my home? Some other people had called about a similar ringing sound. So I think that kind of, makes people perk up and wonder. Within a few weeks, there are a few more people reporting symptoms of chronic malaise, as I describe them. Things like headaches, fatigue, a little bit of vertigo, things like that. And at some point, they basically started to put together this ringing sound and some of these illnesses that they're seeing among, at first, mostly just CIA operatives under diplomatic cover, but then it starts spreading to, a lot of the people working in the Cuban embassy, people in the consular service division, et cetera. The illness spreads. More and more people develop symptoms that they can't explain. And, pretty early on, it seems as if the State Department kind of starts to suspect that this could be a weapon. At first, they kind of described it as a sonic weapon. That was the working thesis. They sat down, everybody who was working in Havana at the time, in early 2017, after just a few cases, and they basically sit all these people down and say, look, we don't know what's going on. We think it's possible that you and your family members might be targeted by a mysterious weapon we know nothing about. So if you start to feel headaches, stomach aches, if you feel a little off balance, you know, just let us know. We think it could be a sonic attack. And, you know, unsurprisingly, dozens and dozens of people come forward to get checked out. They start to, you know, look into these cases. A clinical team sees them in Miami. They start calling it Havana syndrome. They start suspecting that this is the work of a weapon. At first, they thought this was under the Trump administration. There was, you know, this immediate chest thumping assertion that Cuba was probably behind it. And, you know, this obviously dovetailed very conveniently with the fact that the Trump administration was already, you know, very happy to have a pretext to scale back our diplomatic presence in Cuba that had been ramped up during detente under Obama. So this was used as a pretext to basically, you know, par Cuba back down to a skeleton crew in terms of American presence there. But then cases start to spread beyond Cuba, you know, first to China, then to several other countries. I don't know what year and month exactly it spread to which countries, but there have now been alleged cases in Russia, in Vienna, in Colombia, and in the United States, and in Arlington, Virginia, and right in front of the White House. So this has now been going on for several years. There is still no concrete evidence that these were weapons. They did switch from sonic weapons, which makes no sense, to directed energy or microwave weapons, which still makes no sense, but in a different way. And this has just had such a hold on the imaginations of the people in the national security blob. They won't let go of it, and that is still the working thesis for a lot of people in several government agencies, you know, talking about it being an act of war, talking about potentially sanctioning those behind it, strong suspicion that it's Russia, and that the Cubans probably knew about it and said nothing. And that is where we're at.
Now, I'm assuming that all of the cases outside of Cuba have happened in those respective countries' little Havanas, right? I mean, that's just so bizarre that they would think that they would think this thing would spread like that, especially when, you know, it doesn't make sense even for the weaponry, I guess, if you could even call it, that they originally claimed it was. Like, it just doesn't work that way, you know, unless they're claiming that all these countries have their very own Havana syndrome maker machine.
Yeah. So, you know, I can't claim to be an expert in military technology, but my understanding is that the thing that this weapon would have to be, like all of the parameters that it would have to meet to fit into this narrative. So, you know, either building them in several countries or several different countries and people having them, or it being so nimble and portable that it can, you know, move across the globe without being detected. But it's also strong enough to presumably target people from far away. You know, I mean, people felt this in their homes, which means it would have to go through walls. They develop, you know, chronic symptoms, but don't have any, you know, burning sensations or damage to their skin. You know, a lot of microwaves, I think, at a high enough quantity would damage Wi-Fi signals, electronics around. That's never been reported. So when you really sit down and list all of the things that this weapon would have to be, my understanding is that it just does not comport with the laws of physics. To whatever extent we do have directed energy weapons, they are mostly things like crowd control devices. You know, there is something that I think uses either microwaves or something like microwaves, and the idea is that, you know, law enforcement would use them on protesters, and it would basically, you know, have like a microwave, make someone feel warm, give them a burning sensation, and basically make a crowd disperse. But the idea that they inflict chronic symptoms like headache, fatigue, nausea, etc., it just does not line up well with what a lot of people say that these weapons do.
Right. And before we go any further, I have a lot to say based on what you just said. I want to make it clear to people, if it wasn't completely clear, it appears that the Havana Syndrome is bullshit, right?
That is, I mean, yes, that is absolutely my thesis. I think that, so basically my thesis is, if I had to guess, I think that in Havana itself, the first few cases probably followed a classic pattern of what used to be called mass hysteria, what people now call mass sociogenic illness. The best way to think about sociogenic illness is the diagnosis spreads socially in the same way that, you know, a pathogen spreads from person to person. The idea and understanding of this diagnosis also can. In history, there have been a ton of cases of mass sociogenic illness, mass hysteria. One very famous one that is framed that way by a lot of researchers now is the Salem witch trials. You know, some of those girls had these fits of illness, these pseudo seizures, whatever they were, and then, you know, understood them to have been brought on by witchcraft. From there, it's probably a mix of some girls faking it, some doing it involuntarily, some being so petrified that they are sent into a tizzy of some kind. You know, it's difficult to pinpoint on an individual level what is driving these. But what I am guessing happened in Cuba is, you know, this was a situation that was incredibly stressful. It's very, very relevant, I think, that these cases began to appear right after Trump took office. So obviously their personal and professional lives are changing drastically. A lot of these people had just moved to Havana in 2015. Under Obama, there was a warming of relations between the U.S. and Cuba for the first time in many decades, and they ramped up diplomatic presence. And so, you know, on the ground, you know, obviously they're bringing more CIA agents there because they have a pretext to bring them there for, you know, diplomatic cover. But there are also, you know, people working for like the consular division, you know, normal people who are upending their lives, bringing their whole families to Cuba. Months in, the rug gets pulled out from under them. It's stressful. They don't know what's going to happen, like, you know, to their work lives, to their relationships, total slap in the face, blah, blah, blah. So I think that, you know, that context where a few people start to feel symptoms that are classic symptoms of stress, you know, things like headaches, things like fatigue, dizziness, like those are very well documented symptoms of stress, ringing in ears, etc. And then these people heard very early on that they were potentially in danger, that their neighbors were being attacked, that the hypothetical attacks were associated with this strange ringing sound, which a lot of people had also heard. This very famously, some people recorded it and they played it for each other at the embassy before new recruits came to move to Cuba. The State Department would play these recordings for new people so that they would know what to listen for. This recording turned out to be a species of cricket that lives in Cuba. So the ringing sound was very common, and a lot of people had heard it, which I think made them freak out that, okay, if that's the sound, then maybe I have been targeted. Oh my gosh, what is this headache? Starting to filter and notice things that you might just ordinarily shrug off. It's also possible that, you know, some of these people, so I think from there, you know, once Havana syndrome took hold with the sound, with the very stressful situation, from there, the narrative takes hold. And then, you know, everyone who has a job like this in Cuba and then in other countries beyond has heard these stories, right? Like, they know that their colleagues are potentially being targeted, that they are part of a group of people that's potentially being targeted. And so, you know, some of them might have symptoms of stress, anxiety, depression, et cetera. You know, unexplained symptoms are very common. Who knows? I think others are possibly filtering. You know, if you've heard all of these things, like I said, you get a headache, you're gonna start to think the worst. You're going to start noticing every scratch in your throat, et cetera. You know, you'll mention not feeling well, and someone else is going to really convince you that that's something you should see a doctor over, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think that, you know, you can see how it would snowball in any number of ways. Some people might just have something completely unrelated that's, you know, undiagnosed brain tumor or something. Any number of things.
If someone out there could who thinks they're suffering from Havana syndrome isn't getting checked out for something actual and serious like that, and then because they think it's Havana syndrome.
That was just a random example. I think like they are getting checked out to some degree. You know, I don't want to imply that there's no investigation going on at all, but you know, misdiagnosis happens all the time in medicine.
Right. I mean, for me, I know, if you were to ask me if I've ever suffered from Havana syndrome, I would say yes. But my version of Havana syndrome is that every time I hear someone say Havana syndrome, I just automatically hear in the back of my head that Camille Cabello song, you know, Havana, oh, na, na. It's just automatic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, like, you know, every time I hear someone say Havana, you know, just right away, I just hear it. It's just like,
na, na.
And then, you know, let me get back to where now we got that, because I wanted to get that clear, because I wasn't sure if we quite made it clear enough to people that this was not really a thing. Let me get back to what you said earlier. Has there been any non-Americans who have claimed to suffer from this, or is this only affecting Americans?
Very initially in the Cuban cohort, there were a few Canadians that also believed that they had been targeted. This was, you know, especially sinister to the investigators initially, because the relationship between Cuba and Canada is quite good compared to the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. But it turned out that those Canadians all knew the targeted Americans personally. You know, they were neighbors. They had chatted. They were subject to the same social influences as were the Americans who believed that they were victims of these attacks. So it's not too hard to understand why they felt that they had been victimized too. And as far as I know, there have not been any cases in foreign nationals. I will say, so this is something, you know, it's I don't want to say anything mean about these people, but there is a group of people that describe themselves as targeted individuals, who are mentally ill people, in the U.S. and around the world. I think probably mostly, you know, people with different schizoaffective disorders, who believe that they are being stalked by weapons along these lines, and have really latched onto the Havana syndrome story and are organizing to push for recognition that this happens in civilian populations too. But you know, they are not part of the classic Havana syndrome narrative as reported by national security reporters, and that's been elevated by the media.
Right. Now, you had said earlier that there is work being done like on like on Havana syndrome in terms of like researching it, and at least, you know, checking these people out, their symptoms, and trying to figure out what's going on here. What has the research basically found? Like, you know, like you mentioned, the media, especially national security reporters, have been pushing Havana syndrome. We'll go more into that in a minute. But, you know, is there some sort of scientific or medical research or study that they're basically like hanging their hat on, like that they're leaning on to back up their claims?
Yeah, so there have been a few studies that they point to. Right when there were a few cases very early on that were tied to the screeching noise in Cuba, they were sent to this clinical team in Miami, headed by this guy named Michael Hoffer, who he has a security clearance, and he's worked with the military on, you know, brain injuries in soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, that kind of thing. And so he looked at several of the early cases and ended up publishing two studies. These studies, he has touted them as, you know, objective proof that something happened to these people. But the claims that he's made in the media have really wildly outpaced what the studies actually show. He has been, you know, again, a military guy, very confident about, you know, referring to these as probable microwave attacks, you know, overstating the findings. He used this measurement tool that are these like goggles that tend to be used like on the sidelines during a sports game to like gauge if someone might have a concussion, but they're not necessarily used a lot in clinical medicine. He has potentially a proprietary relationship with them. His studies were both published in like Z-list journals. You know, sometimes those kind of journals publish good work, like these predatory, obscure journals. But, you know, I think that if this study that claims to have, you know, objective proof that these people were attacked by a heretofore unknown weapon, and it can only be published in like a Z-list journal, one of which this doctor was on the actual board of, that's a red flag, right? That shouldn't necessarily imbue you with confidence about the level of work. A couple years later, in 2018, the State Department commissioned a scientific study into this that was just released via FOIA to a reporter this year. But that study specifically expressed a lot of concern about this researcher, this ear, nose, and throat military doctor who claimed that there's objective evidence of brain injury in these people. So there was that. Then there was also a clinical team at the University of Pennsylvania, which is, you know, a little more above board. They published two studies in the Journal of the American Medical Association. You know, also, I think, pretty assertive that, oh, yeah, there's something here. There's something here. I think that there were two studies. One, two sets of MRIs. One was a normal clinical MRI that you might get if you go to the hospital, and those really showed nothing amiss. The other set of MRIs was a, you know, more sensitive, deeper research MRI that did show a few differences between these patients, the Havana syndrome patients, and control patients. But they're the sort of changes that aren't necessarily unusual, that, you know, potentially could be caused by any number of things, depression, stress, anxiety, substance use, et cetera. You know, it's not as if any MRI holds up a little sign that says, you know, a microwave weapon was here.
Right.
The idea that there is, yeah, like the idea that any brain imaging shows irrefutable evidence of any of this is, you know, a completely erroneous idea that somehow made its way into this conversation. I also think it's important, you know, both sets of physicians were basically brought these circle, told, hey, we think these people might have been attacked by something mysterious. Can you check them out and tell us if we're right? Like, I think a lot of, you know, I think that they're, it's very possible to imagine that someone would be like professionally swept up by that sort of suggestion and that sort of, you know, I mean, excitement maybe is even a way to think about it. You know, but certainly that clinician, Douglas Smith, the lead author on those studies, I think has definitely overstated what his research says too. Even more concerning, the Smith article said something along the lines of, you know, these symptoms can't be psychogenic because there's no way they could fake these things. And that really misunderstands what sociogenic illness is. I don't think that these people are faking. I think that they are suffering. I think that they are being utterly sincere. And they just were never attacked by weapons, and these weapons don't exist. And all of those things can be true at the same time.
Right, right. Now you brought up the weapons again, so that's perfect, because that was going to be the next thing I wanted to bring up. You know, the idea that these, you know, I feel like, you know, with the U.S. military being, you know, the most, you know, well-funded and most powerful military entity in the world, we would know, at least, I gotta assume, somewhat, what these weapons were, if they really were truly some sort of weaponry out there pulling this off. But they don't seem to know, and like you said, it doesn't seem like the technology behind these weapons even exists. What is the claim really that like Cuba has figured out some like technological advancement that U.S. has? And I'm not putting Cuba down. I mean, they're very intelligent. They have medical breakthroughs there, obviously, and well-educated doctors and medical field. What I'm saying is, like, this seems like expensive technology that at least the U.S. would be aware of if it existed.
Yeah, I mean, so most people, most proponents of this theory think that Russia has done it and that Cuba is in on it. So Cuba just knows what's going on and isn't saying anything.
Has anyone asked those people what year they think it is? Because, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a worthwhile question. The year when it comes to the weapons research is important because a lot of proponents of the theory like to say, oh, well, you know, Russia has long been doing this kind of research, or, you know, this kind of project existed. And a lot of it is outdated. Like, it is true that Russia and to some extent the United States has done a lot of research into this kind of thing. But a lot of it ended decades ago, you know, largely because it wasn't super fruitful. So, you know, the idea that there is super extensive contemporaneous research into this kind of weapon, I haven't found too much strong evidence of that kind of thing. As for whether the military could detect it or not, I guess I don't know too much about like warcraft, spycraft, that kind of thing. But I do think that the fact that, yeah, years and years into this, the most powerful, richest country on Earth with the biggest military, with the biggest, you know, intelligence apparatus, does not have a shred of concrete evidence, not just about who wielded this weapon, but whether there is a weapon, whether these illnesses were caused by weapons at all, like, that should give people just extraordinary pause. I think that says a lot. We've got nothing, and it's been 5 years. And yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, people will say absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, but God, at some point it has to be, right? Like when you're claiming a completely imaginary hypothetical theory, I guess it could always be true because it's hard to disprove total nonsense.
Right. Now, in your piece in the New Republic, you draw a pretty straight line to how, you know, back during the Bush administration, how reminiscent this is of, you know, Colin Powell before the UN and, you know, the Bush administration trying to convince everyone that, you know, Saddam Hussein in Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. You know, do you think, like, what is the play here from, you know, the U.S., you know, the security state here, you think? Like, it's not like, are they trying to go to war with Cuba, or is this more directly to continue pushing, you know, our issues with Russia? Which, you know, to me, it's always bizarre because there are plenty real problems with Russia where the U.S. doesn't need to make this stuff up. Like, you know, there are legitimate issues with Russia, but I guess they feel like they can't make those because maybe it hits too close to home, too. What do you think the play is here?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is definitely the point at which I've like, lightly followed this story for a few years now, and I thought it was amusing that, you know, I always just thought it was complete BS. And so seeing people, you know, very, very seriously pontificate about weapons was just funny to me. And then, you know, over the past year or so, it really started to piss me off for some of the reasons that you're talking about. I think that, you know, the weapons theory just will not die. You have people who are really agitating for a response of some kind. One of the highest profile victims, quote unquote, this guy, Mark Polymeropoulos, who is in the CIA, he's pretty openly and explicitly connected this to Russia and has started talking about retaliation in the form of, you know, troop buildup in NATO countries, et cetera, things like that. So, you know, it is one of those things where the more this narrative persists, the more there will be internal and external pressure to do something about it. That said, in terms of what the play is, the answer is a little more complicated. I feel like a lot of people, you know, on left Twitter, which thankfully is very skeptical about Havana Syndrome, pretty universally, as far as I can tell. I feel like a lot of people, you know, assert that it's clear that the CIA is making this up as a pretext. What the reaction and how it's played out looks to me is that there's a lot of internal division about this. I think that there is an extremely passionate, noisy cohort that absolutely believes that these are mysterious, invisible attacks by Russia and that they are really driving the narrative. But the narrative would have gotten further by now were it not for the fact that there are within these agencies a ton of people just don't buy it and I think are mostly just not saying anything. Either because they're not certain or because it's awkward, because they don't want to come out and contradict their colleagues' stories about being targeted. So yeah, I think that it's not necessarily, you know, an intelligent design with someone, you know, being a puppet master coming up with this story so as to be able to expand military presence on the Russian border or whatever it is. I think that it's something that began organically, that a lot of people latched onto, that kind of has a life of its own at this point. But I do think it's dangerous because if it doesn't get stopped in its tracks, if people don't come to their senses, you know, you can't peddle the idea that there has been attacks around the globe and not expect there to be some response. I mean, a lot of public officials are kind of already coming at it from that direction. Susan Collins, Tim Kaine, Marco Rubio, Jean Sheehan, like they are definitely all on the Havana Syndrome train and are, you know, chest thumping about how we have to capital D, do something. So I think, you know, even though not everyone buys it, it can still end up in a dangerous place.
Did the Trump administration ever make any claims about Havana Syndrome?
So in the very, very early days, they did accept it and, like I said, use it as a major pretext
to
scale back diplomatic presence in Cuba, which, of course, is something that they already wanted to do. You know, Marco Rubio was an early traveler. Of course, like, his whole shtick is, I hate Cuba. So as soon as there was a rumbling about this, you know, he stands up and, what did I tell you? You know, that kind of thing. You know, by all accounts, Gina Haspel seems to not have bought it. You know, there was a lot of hesitancy to move on it. The Trump administration commissioned this State Department independent science panel that determined not only that
The Skype call broke up a little bit. Can you just go back a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So Gina Haspel, I think, was pretty skeptical of this from the get-go. There wasn't necessarily a lot of movement from other agencies either. The Trump State Department is the one that commissioned this independent scientific advisory panel that ended up determining not only that that recording was crickets, but that there was likely a sociogenic component to all this. So I think that the Trump administration was kind of, you know, acting in the way that you'd expect when maybe there are some people who think this is happening and a lot don't. I do think that perhaps that informed the political reaction under the Biden administration. I think a lot of people who were onlookers or, you know, people who were critical of Trump and adjacent to the NatSec blob probably, you know, resented the idea that our troops are getting attacked by Trump's favorite country and he's not doing anything. Well, I'll do something. I will avenge these attacks. You know, I think that there might be that dynamic at play to some extent. But, you know, knock on wood, it's not a fully unified response. But that said, I think that the people who are utterly convinced that this is directed energy weapons and that these are attacks, there's a huge enthusiasm gap between those people who care very, very deeply and think this is the most important thing in the world and the people who kind of think it's bullshit but just aren't saying anything, right? Like, it's easy for that group to get steamrolled. And so I think it's important that there be an angry response to those chest bumpers.
Right. Right. Now, who are the, you know, we talked about who in, you know, the government is sort of pushing this. But obviously, as you mentioned, this is being buoyed by the media. Who are some of the people really pushing this to, well, really to the public, because, you know, the government is just claiming what they think this is. It's the, you know, the reporter, the journalist, the job to really write the articles that get into the in front of people who are going to say, hey, what's this Havana Syndrome here thing here? We have to do something about this, America.
Yeah. So by far, the most egregious and irresponsible journalist on this topic has been Julia Ioffe. She last year wrote a very splashy magazine piece that focused on this guy, Mark Polymeropoulos, that I mentioned earlier, and that really very explicitly, with barely any hedging, talked about these as being attacks, talked about Russia as being behind it.
Like outright, you know, like, very, like that's like factual, not like a theory, like Russia is behind it.
Yeah. I mean, she framed it as a mystery, but then throughout the whole piece, really talked about it as if it was a foregone conclusion in a way that, I'm actually surprised got past the editors. So her GQ piece, I think, got a ton of attention. And, you know, I mean, she's a good writer stylistically. So I think it was like a well-paced, sensational story that really just drew people in. She wrote an even more egregiously reported story for Puck News, which is a new news outlet that probably not many people have heard of. But so she has not scaled back her ridiculousness when it comes to this story. Adam Entus with The New Yorker has been more careful. He has never just, you know, explicitly and casually framed them as attacks without hedging the way that Ioffe has. But I do think that he's been incredibly credulous about the narrative itself. He's been, you know, very dismissive of the idea that this could be sociogenic. You know, he's a little more agnostic about who's behind it, but I think has absolutely bought into the more toxic parts of the narrative. And because he writes for The New Yorker and has written several really extensively reported pieces on this, I think has done a lot of heavy lifting in terms of bringing this narrative to the public. There's this new Andrew Desiderio and Laura Seligman, I think, at Politico have started to follow the story in a completely credulous way. Ed Yong and a national security team at the New York Times used to publish a lot of bullcrap about this. I haven't seen them do it lately, and New York Times has actually published two recent skeptical op-eds, so maybe there's been, you know, some pushback internally there. There have also been some, like, you know, TV reporters at NBC, MSNBC, who have taken this incredibly seriously and who frame any idea, like any suggestion that this could be sociogenic as something that's, you know, just egregiously cruel to these poor victims, which is very frustrating. But it's definitely been a group effort. A lot of people have peddled this in a way that really just makes you want to smack your forehead.
Right. I mean, even, you know, even if you don't want to outright dismiss the possibility, you also can't outright just spread rumor and hearsay and theories to make the claim either. You need to show the skepticism all around, at the very least, I would assume.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's what surprises me so much about it. I've thought a lot about this, and I think that one reason that that narrative has stuck and one reason that they think that sociogenic illness sounds so implausible is that a lot of people don't understand just how common these symptoms really are. You know, they can be extremely debilitating. People are suffering a lot. It can even be the kind of thing, you know, people who have these symptoms can need time off work, can be disabled by them. All of those things can be true. And it's also true that clusters of symptoms like, you know, headaches, fatigue, dizziness, ringing ears, things like that. I mean, I'm sure that you know people in your life who have experienced things like that, who have been debilitated by things like that. Possibly connected to mental health, possibly not, and maybe just never even diagnosed. You know, I think something like 25 to 50% of primary care and outpatient neurology visits can be these unexplained symptoms. A lot of shit happens in our bodies and with our health that can't totally be explained.
Right.
And so the idea that this has happened to, you know, a total of 200 or 300 Americans out of the tens of thousands that we have stationed overseas over a course of 5 years is not remarkable at all. And so I think that if more people understood just how common these symptom presentations are, you know, that would really change the context, because it would no longer look like, well, how did all of these people get sick then? Or how do you explain this? Like, it's very easy to explain. It's unfortunate. I'm sorry that people are sick and I'm sorry that they're suffering, but it is not this mystery. It's not that confusing. It's something that we live with every day. It's something that, you know, double digit percentage of the population might be dealing with at any given time, depending on the symptom. So I think if more people understood that, a lot of the lingering questions about this would fall away.
Yeah, the symptoms seem pretty, you know, basic all around. Like, these are symptoms that, like, you know, you have through just, like, you know, you get a migraine, or obviously there are worse symptoms people are saying, but again, all very big, like the ringing of your ears, like, you know, obviously that's maybe not something that happens as often as the headache and things like that, but that's still something that happens. And to not have an underlying, like, you know, virus or something to associate it with, it seems bizarre to just assume that it's this mysterious illness being, you know, created by these energy microwave weapons. Has there been any, on the flip side, you know, you had mentioned, you know, medical and scientific research that went into trying to prove that this is a thing. Has there been, on the flip side, any medical or scientific researchers who have looked at this and said, like, you know, from a non-political standpoint, like from the scientific standpoint, like, this just not, this does not make any sense. It's not possible.
Yeah, there's definitely been a growing chorus of people who are skeptical from a number of angles. Two of the most persistently skeptical and whose work I find pretty persuasive is this team, Robert Bartholomew and Robert Ballow. Robert Bartholomew is, I believe, a sociologist at maybe the University of Auckland in New Zealand, I want to say. And he is basically the world's expert on mass sociogenic illness. He's written a ton, like a couple books about this kind of thing. He's written a ton of review articles. I mean, I sat and Skyped with him once, and he straight up told me, you know, I would bet my life that this is mass sociogenic illness. It just fits the pattern so perfectly. It doesn't really leave any lingering questions. So he's really pushed back a lot. He co-wrote a book with this guy named Robert Ballow, who is a neurologist from UCLA. And he originally was one of the peer reviewers on the first JAMA study presented by Doug Smith's team. So, you know, this brain injury team from the University of Pennsylvania that's upheld as evidence that these people have brain injuries that were caused by weapons. He recommended that the journal not publish it. He basically said it was science fiction. He said that, you know, the abnormalities were not very specific, could be explained by a lot of things. The journal, you know, bulldozed him and published it anyway, which is not necessarily super common, that, you know, if you have one peer reviewer really emphatically say this should not be published, this is science fiction, it's surprising that it did get published. And I think that that probably speaks to, you know, this was splashy and this was sexy, and a lot of institutions get carried away by that kind of thing. Or like excited to be in on the ground floor of this, you know, new and horrifying novel story. So the two of them have been pretty outspoken. I think I've read, you know, more and more comments from physicians, clinicians, especially, you know, I think coming from the same point of view that I was just describing, that, you know, I think maybe a national security person reads, like, these spies were at the top of their game, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, hear a strange noise, have a sharp pain, and then couldn't stop having headaches, couldn't stand up straight. Like, I think that, you know, for a national security reporter without much context about health and illness, that sounds like, oh my gosh, case closed. What else could that be? These guys aren't crazy. Like, they're smart, tough guys. Well, how do you explain this? And I think that for a lot of people with more experience with clinical medicine, I think that they hear a story like that and it's very familiar. they have a lot of sympathy for it, but I think that, you know, they approach it from a completely different direction.
Right.
So I've heard some pushback from them. In terms of other scientists, Cheryl Roefer and Kenneth Foster, Kenneth Foster is an expert on microwaves, and he has said that this doesn't make sense, that it's really not plausible. He's had a lot of funny lines saying, you know, saying that these things are caused by microwave weapons. You might as well say that little green men landed from Mars to do this. That's how plausible it sounds. And he's at UPenn. And then Cheryl Roefer worked at, I want to say, at Los Alamos. She was a chemist at Argonne National Laboratory and has said that the weapon as described is just not scientifically plausible.
Right.
So there have been some people pushing back against this, but, you know, at the end of the day, excuse me, it's a very complicated story. Like, as someone who has fallen down this stupid rabbit hole, it takes a long time to figure out the ins and outs. And, you know, I think a lot of people are out most of the time, like any of us, and, you know, haven't necessarily heard all of the details. And if they did, maybe they'd be more skeptical.
Right, right. To think this all seemingly started with crickets, right? I mean, that really seems to be the real, the real issue here is those crickets, you know.
I mean, I think if it weren't for the cricket noises that everyone agreed that they recognized, not knowing they were crickets at the time, that's what made them go to weapons so quickly. And that just really got entrenched. I think who knows if they would have thought maybe this is attack without that. But that is how they landed on that theory and just have not left it since.
Right. This has been really fascinating, and really, I think this is something most people don't know too much about, and whether or not they've heard of Havana Syndrome, I'm sure it's not something that's just gonna go away in terms of, you know, suddenly there's. I mean, it could, I guess. I mean, I guess if they realize this isn't working, it does seem like something that could be. I feel like it's at the cusp of, like, it could just be dropped. And most people would just forget it to history.
Well, and that is usually how mass sociogenic illness ends. Basically people stop talking about it, they forget about it, and things die down. Because I think, like, you know, the media and the, you know, social buildup is part of what spreads these illnesses. And I think that Havana Syndrome is just this interesting situation where, because there is this national security component, it won't die.
Right.
Like, there are people who, you know, because they think they are fighting enemies and getting to the bottom of this big story, like journalists and patient advocates themselves and people within these agencies really just keep pushing it. And that's why it's still happening.
Right. Natalie Shore, columnist for New Republic. The article in the New Republic is in the description on the YouTube and Patreon page. Where is your next piece, the one that's coming out this weekend? By the time, you know, the live stream viewers will have to wait, but if you people who catch this on the podcast, your piece will probably be out by the time this goes up. So where can people find that piece?
It's in Slow Boring, which is Matt Iglesias' Substack. It's a long piece, really going through a lot of the details. Reporting. So if you want to see that, it really gets into the nitty-gritty of why this is ridiculous, I recommend it.
It sounds really interesting. Based on what we were just talking about right now, I really look forward to reading it. Where also feel free to promote anything else you'd like. Tell people where they can find you online, anything else you have coming up that you want to plug that may or may not be Havana Syndrome related. Go ahead.
I'm on Twitter at Natalie Shirley, NataliesUrely. And spend way too much time on that website. So would love to see anybody.
I think that's the syndrome we actually really do all have. And we know the cause of that one, right? Take care, Natalie. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. It was really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Matt. It was fun.
Take care.
Have a good one.
All right, everybody. I got to tell you, I was, this is not what I want to do. Give me one second here. This is what I want to do. I was really thinking about playing this sound clip before the show started. I was thinking about playing this sound clip every time the word Havana was mentioned.
Nana.
And then it dawned on me right before I hit it for the intro of the show that maybe I should save it and just do it once during the actual interview, because I didn't want people to find it distracting, which it certainly would have been, being that we said Havana
Nana
so many times during obviously a show on the Havana Nana Syndrome. It would have been bad, but I think that's the real Havana Syndrome. Because I honestly can't say the word Havana
Nana
without hearing that. Let's go to the second half of the show. But before doing that, let me plug a few things. First of all, patreon.com/Matt Binder. And bad news, didn't get many patrons. Over this past week or so, I would say a weekly low, to be honest. Our new patrons, who really, I got an extra shout out to these folks for giving me something to mention during this part of the show. John P. and Dan S., thank you so much for becoming patrons. Usually have at least a few more names to mention. Don't want to dip below the goal, folks. We've had, obviously there's ebbs and flows and cancellations and new subscribers, but as you can see, the new subscribers didn't quite match up with the cancellations, and we're threatening to dip below that 300 plus mark. So if you've ever thought of becoming a patron on Patreon and haven't already, now would be a great time to do so. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. On the flip side, over at twitch.tv/Matt Binder, since I've been an affiliate, I've gotten a number of paid subscriptions there. So if Twitch is your thing, feel free to do the paid subscription there. If you are a Patreon subscriber or can't afford to be a Patreon subscriber, and want to know a way to monetarily support this show more or at all, and are an Amazon Prime subscriber, at no extra cost to you, Amazon gives you one free paid Twitch subscription each month. So if you have Amazon Prime already, like you already pay for it, or your parents already pay for it, or a loved one that you're sharing an account with is already paying for it, and they're not already subscribed to someone on Twitch, you can basically give me free money from Jeff Bezos. Again, costs nothing extra to you if you're already an Amazon Prime subscriber. Just got to connect your Twitch account to your Amazon Prime account, and then you go to twitch.tv/Matt Binder, and you can subscribe. Give me some of Jeff Bezos' money, again, at no extra cost to you. Some people have done that already at Twitch. Some people have actually paid for Twitch subscriptions. I guess they're more Twitch users. That's cool. The people who have subscribed to my Twitch channel with a paid subscription over the past, since the last episode of the show, let me give them a shout out too. Series Business, Real Ace Attorney, Delusium. Let's see who else. Mad as Hell, Miranda Montana, with the subscription and a community gift subscription. Oh, that's a bonus right there. Process Psych 7 with a subscription. Killed by Magikarp with a subscription. Focac with a Twitch subscription. And I think that might be everyone since the last episode of the show. Yes, I think that is. Thank you all. Oh, we got someone jumping in at the last minute over on Twitch. White Damp with the Twitch subscription. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. You could also support this show by subscribing at youtube.com/MattBinder. Following on Twitch. That's free. That's different from the Twitch subscription. Twitch.tv/MattBinder. Leave a podcast review. RateThisPodcast.com/doomed. That's RateThisPodcast.com/doomed. Go there. There's a list of links where you can leave reviews for this show. The podcast version of the show goes up a few days after the live stream. DoomedCast.com is where you can catch that. This past Tuesday, I did a Twitch stream that I also cut for YouTube later on. Breaking down a Jimmy Dore segment on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Just really not good work over there at the Dore show on this. And I broke it down. You should check that out. What else? Follow me at Matt Binder on Twitter, Instagram, wherever you want to check me out. Still demonetized on YouTube. Still demonetized on YouTube. Still demonetized on YouTube. So fortunately, still ain't getting any super chats. But if you go to my Twitter account on your mobile phone, your smartphone, your mobile device. Mobile phone works too, even though it makes me sound like an old man. And you go to my Twitter account, there is a tip jar option where you can go there, click that tip jar, and Twitter will show you my Patreon, but also my Venmo and Cash App account. If you can't subscribe for the recurring fee of Patreon and you're not much of a Twitch person, you can go and give me a one-time thank you, tip, donation, whatever you want to call it, via Venmo or Cash App. Totally up to you. And also, as always, if you can't monetarily support the show at all, I totally understand. Don't feel the pressure of doing that. But you can still help out this show greatly by just telling people about it. Share YouTube clips that you see that you like. Tell people to check out the podcast if your friend or family member is more of a podcast listener. Just get it out there if you can. If you really enjoy this show and want to support, that's a really great way you can. What else? I think that's it. Let's go to the second half of the show. I'll be opening up the phone lines. Open up your Skype app and call in Doomed Live. Just search Doomed Live. You'll see it show up on Skype. I'm signing into the phone system now. What else? I think that's it for now. I was on the Majority Report earlier today. Feel free to check that out. Oh, I also had a hit with the BBC, BBC Radio and their podcast on the a crypto story, which I'll talk more about in the second half of the show that we're going into now. And if you're on the live stream, if you're a Patreon subscriber, feel free to stick around. If you're not watching live and you're not subscribed to the Patreon, I will see you all next time on Doomed.